Can I apologise to everybody here because John Gray, who sits beside me here, is giving two lectures tonight, one at 5:30 and the other at 6:00. So we decided to go for the 6:00 one, but I do apologise to anyone who came at 5:30. There were two posters with different times on them. This is the first joint LSE Economist Bookshop lecture. We're very pleased to be hosting this event jointly, and it will, we hope, be the first of many, and also signal the lasting partnership which we have. The Economist Bookstop shop is a core part of the LSE campus. We're welcoming tonight John Gray, who's just published his book. You can see copies outside and hopefully buy copies outside. False Dawn, The Delusions of Global Capitalism. John Gray was Professor of Politics at the University of Oxford. I'm delighted to stress the was, and is one of the world's most distinguished political philosophers. He joined the LSE in January this year as Professor of European Thought, attached to the European Institute. John has held numerous appointments, including as a visitor Professor of Government at Harvard, Distinguished Professor at Yale, Visiting Professor at the Autonomous University in Madrid, and British Council Distinguished Professor at the Portuguese Catholic University. As many people here will know, he writes widely on current political events and controversies and is a regular contributor to the Guardian newspaper. I'm asked to point out he'll be signing copies of his book, either on stage or outside, according to how things go after the lecture. We're very pleased, I'm personally very pleased, I should say publicly, that John has joined the LSE. Very important for us. I'm very pleased that he's decided to move here. And of course, I'm very happy to introduce his lecture, the title of which is The Futures of Globalization, Professor John Gray.
Thank you very much, Tony, for that very generous introduction. I'm sorry that some of you turned up too early. I'll try and begin by elucidating what I meant by the title of the lecture. What I meant by the title of the lecture is that globalization is not a single condition, an endpoint in social and economic development, which we must inevitably accept. What globalization essentially is, I'm going to argue, isn't an inexorable historical process, but it can be developed in several different ways. It's an open-ended historical process in important respects. So by talking about the futures of globalization, I want to dispel the idea, or at least to question the idea, that we're fated or destined to live in a globalized world of a certain particular kind. Indeed, one of my main distinctions, which I'll try and make in this brief lecture, is between globalization as a process or a set of historical processes of great force, long duration, that will persist into the foreseeable future, on the one hand, and on the other hand, a particular way of organizing the global economy into a global free market, which is only one way in which it might be organized, and it's a way, I think, which is less durable, more ephemeral than globalization itself. Globalization, as I shall try to suggest, began well before there was a global free market, and it will continue long after there's been one. A global free market is simply one phase, one episode, one moment, if you like, in the history of globalization. But let me, to begin with, the questions I want to try and answer about the ways in which globalization may develop in the coming years. I want to answer six questions. I want to ask what globalization actually is. Secondly, what drives it? Thirdly, just to hammer home the first one, what globalization is not? Fourthly, why a global free market is a utopia, and I think a somewhat dangerous utopia. Fifthly, why some alternatives to a global free market are not real alternatives. And lastly, what a real alternative to a global free market might look like. So there's the sort of six questions or topics, each of them very large questions, each of them involving a lot of argument and a lot of assumptions and a lot of interpretation of evidence. But I'll try my best to answer them in a way which at least provides a basis for subsequent conversation and discussion. So firstly, what is globalization? Well, in its broadest understanding, globalization is a widening and deepening of interconnections between economic and cultural life throughout the world. One of the best definitions or short statements of what globalization means or is has been made by Tony Giddens in one of his books. He says globalization is the intensification of worldwide social relations in such a way that local happenings are shaped by events occurring many miles away and vice versa. I think that is perhaps the best definition of it I know. And what globalization means then in that broad, abstract understanding of it is delocalization of activities and relationships from their original local origins and contexts. It means the displacement of those activities, of activities that were until recently predominantly local, into networks whose reach is distant or even worldwide. Signs or symptoms of globalization are, in the case of economic or market globalization, the emergence of world market prices for an increasing range of goods. A different sign or symptom of globalization in the cultural realm is the rapid growth of virtual communities, communities that are detached from any particular territory or physical locality. They're both signs of this ongoing process. Now, if that's what globalization is, I think we can then move on to the question of what drives it? Why is it advancing? Why is it occurring at an ever faster pace? What is it that's bringing it about? And there I want to argue that what drives globalization is what might be called, using the French word, the banalization of new technologies. Most particularly, the banalization of recent distance abolishing new information technologies. New technologies are being diffused, copied, adapted, applied swiftly all over the world at an increasingly rapid rate. Of course, we all know that not all new technologies are equally available to everyone. But the spread of new technologies is unstoppable. It's wholly inexorable. And in some ways, one hopes an increasing number of ways, given wise policy, it's highly desirable. It's only an expression of the spread of industrial production throughout the world, which has been going on perhaps for two centuries, according to some historians, a lot longer. What doesn't drive globalization, what isn't its fundamental motor, although it has contributed to its acceleration, is market deregulation. So one of the fundamental distinctions I want to make is between this underlying historical trend or process, on the one hand, and the comparatively ephemeral, as I think they may prove to be, or at any rate have been up till now, they haven't lasted all that long, compared with the history of globalization itself, phenomena of particular policies of market deregulation. Globalization began before there was deregulation. It'll continue long after present policies of deregulation have been modified, reformed, or abandoned. Of course, we need to recognize that large political events have in some ways advanced globalization by knocking down barriers to the mobility of capital and to flows of goods that had existed before. The obvious example is the fall of Soviet communism. We live in a post-socialist world, one in which there are no longer two economic systems, but only varieties of one, capitalism. And that, I think, is an irreversible feature, probably, although we can't see into the future. It looks to me as if it's likely or plausible to think that that disappearance of socialism or central economic planning from the world is, for any future that we can now foresee, irreversible, and I still think largely beneficial. At present, the varieties of capitalism that the world contains interact with one another in a framework that emerged in the aftermath of the Soviet collapse. That framework institutionalizes this mobility, this worldwide mobility of capital and of unregulated global free trade. So I'm not saying that deregulation of trade and capital has no importance at all. I'm just saying that it isn't what fundamentally drives globalization. As I'll argue later, certain pseudo-solutions, certain mistaken or alternatives to present global economic arrangements, such as protectionism, wouldn't actually deeply affect globalization, because the fundamental motor of it, which is in continuous technological innovation, particularly innovation of in the contexts of new information technologies, would go on behind the tariff walls. So it would be a superficial and in many ways anachronistic and perverse idea to imagine that the solution to some of the problems which have been generated by globalization, or to some of the costs and risks that it carries with it, is in a set of policies coming from the past which really don't address its fundamental engine. Those who argue for protectionism as a way of coping with globalization make the same mistake, it seems to me, as neoliberals and others who argue for it do when they identify globalization with the fairly superficial and ephemeral, though nonetheless in some contexts quite important, phenomenon of market deregulation. What isn't globalization? Well, let me just run through a few of the things that I think it's not. And I'm not alone in thinking the way I do about these things. A number of other recent writers have come to rather similar conclusions. The first point is one I just touched on right at the beginning of my observations, which is that globalization is not an end state of historical change. It is a powerful, I would say, practically inexorable, practically unstoppable historical process, but it's not a final point towards which all societies and economies are converging. When one reads some of the business literature about globalization, and hears some political speeches about globalization, I'm rather reminded of the sort of thing that Sidney and Beatrice Webb wrote in the 1930s about Soviet communism when they published their famous book, Soviet Communism, A New Civilization, which, as some of you will know, in the first edition had a question mark after it, but in the second edition had it been removed. I think I'm the only one to have read the third edition, which is an exclamation mark. But it's a rather occult volume. I'm reminded, nonetheless, of this of the flavor of this kind of talk of historical inevitability, because not only is it argued that globalization is inevitable, which it is, but it's also argued that it has a sort of telos, an endpoint, that is bound to lead to a world having certain characteristics. It's bound to lead to economic and social and political life right throughout the world having certain common characteristics. Well, I think that's one of the first things globalization is not. And one of the people with whom I share this view is David Held, former colleague of Tony Giddens and someone I know well, who in an important book to be published next year on globalization has put it fairly pithily, I think, and correctly. Globalization is not a singular condition. It's not a linear process. It's not a final endpoint of social change. What else is globalization not? Well, it's not a universal state of equal integration in worldwide economic activity. To say that the world is becoming more globalized, or that globalization is advancing or accelerating, is not to say that we're approaching a circumstance in which every part of the world will be somehow equally integrated in worldwide economic activity. And one can be a little more precise about that. On the contrary, increased interconnections of economic activity throughout the world are occurring, but in many contexts what they do is accentuate uneven development. That's to say, globalization isn't a process which is going on at roughly the same rate all over the world and which is having roughly the same effects. Globalization is a set of historical processes that in many contexts accentuate uneven development between different countries. E.g., it can be argued that some globalizing processes have exaggerated the dependency of peripheral developing states, such as Mexico, on economies nearer the center, such as the United States. So, although it's true that one consequence of globalization is that some hierarchical relations between states are weakening, and if you want an example of that, I would say an example of the relations between China and Western governments are less hierarchical now. China is less prone to be swayed, bullied, cajoled with, or threatened than it's been in the past. Others are strengthened. So it by no means has the tendency, globalization universally, to produce greater equality of condition or of power between economies or societies. In some contexts it does, in others it may enhance inequality. The basic point is that globalization does not tend to diminish differences between economies or countries. On the contrary. And this leads me to my next observation about what globalization is not. Each of these can be seen actually as iterations or reworkings of the same thing. Globalization isn't homogenization. There's a common critique, I think, of sort of rather banal and superficial critique of globalization, which says it's leading to the whole world becoming the same. I think exactly the opposite is true. There are those who favor a certain vision of globalization, who want it to be true, but it's not happening, and I don't think it seems likely to happen. Why isn't it happening? Well, the first and rather obvious point is that global markets in which capital and production itself move freely across frontiers work as they do precisely because of differences between localities, nations, and regions, if impossibly, wages, skills, infrastructures, and political risks were the same throughout the world, then market globalization could not have occurred in the way it had. There wouldn't have been the profits to be made, there wouldn't have been the opportunities for productive change. So it's not at all, the case that globalization, so to speak, thrives on homogenization or produces it. But nor does globalization produce cultural homogenization. Now again, it's true that brands for some consumer goods are no longer country-specific. It's also true, I think this is an important point actually, that most European countries, to take an example, absorb more from Hollywood movies than they do from each other. If polls are being carried out trying to identify which images are most widely dispersed across members of the people living in EU countries. And you may or may not be surprised to learn that the images that are most held in common are not European images, but American images. So it is true that in certain respects, some images are being propagated and commonly shared throughout the world. But that's by no means the whole truth, and not even the most important truth, about the impact of globalization on culture. On the contrary, one of the most important consequences of the development of new technologies is that they enable cultures that are geographically scattered and communities that are geographically scattered to interact with one another more continuously and more easily. So, in some respects, the new technologies, communications technologies that are driving globalization, remember that's what's driving them, not deregulation, act to express and deepen cultural differences. They even act sometimes to reconstitute communities that have been scattered, e.g. Kurdish exiles, I'm told, in European countries have managed to preserve their common culture partly through a Kurdish television station. So it's by no means the case that globalization always works, or even typically works, to steamroller cultural difference. At the surface level of globally accessible cultural imageries, it might appear to do so. But in some ways, and perhaps deeper ways, globalization is working to break up the homogeneous territorial cultures that were constructed in the 19th and 20th centuries. It works, if you like, to make multiculturalism more of a universal condition. But that's not to generate homogenization. That's to enhance differences. So the universal proliferation of a few similar images seems to me to be a relatively surface effect of globalization, of global communications media. It's not an irresistible trend. Globalization isn't either a return to the pre-1914 international economy. Some of the best writing on globalization actually has been done by former Marxists. I rather regret I never was a Marxist because I could now have the opportunity of being an ex-Marxist, but I think is in many ways an advantageous position to have, because at least you know a good amount of history. At least you've got a grounding in a good amount of history. And some former Marxists have argued that if you look back at the world between about 1870, 1880 up to 1914, you'll find an international economic order which was open, which has had large capital movements, which were pretty well unconstrained in large parts of it, there were free trade, looks very like globalization. Now, I don't want to say that that had nothing in it of globalization. Indeed, it might even be true that that was one of the earlier phases of it. I think that is true, actually. But the differences seem to me to be more important for the future and for understanding the present than the similarities. What were the differences? Well, one rather important difference, I think, is that the pre-1914 international liberal economic order depended on European hegemony in the world. It was maintained by the power of European colonial countries. Non-European countries such as China were wholly subordinated. Up till the 1860s, Japan was isolated. India was colonized. That international liberal international order was, if you like, a construction of European colonial power. Now, I don't want to say that colonial relationships have disappeared. A lot of trade is still within what are normally called Western countries, although that includes Japan in most descriptions of the situation. But certainly, I think the situation, that world, the world in which there were clear relationships of subordination between Western powers and non-Western powers, and in which an open international liberal trade order, for example, was maintained by gunboats, that world is disappearing or has substantially altered, as has the social order on which the Victorian free market, which was the domestic national expression of the free market in that time, that's disappeared too. And there are many other differences: the size of capital flows, the development of the new technologies which permit the growth of a kind of virtual economy and derivatives and other exotic instruments. But the main difference between then and now is the disappearance, or at least the weakening, of European hegemony. We have one remaining quasi-hegemonic power in the world, namely the United States, which is a Western power. But its hegemony is not, I think, it's arguable, but it's not in many contexts, perhaps will in future be in a diminishing range of contexts, akin to that of the European powers pre-1914. Globalization isn't either the disappearance or impotence of sovereign states. Again, if you read some of the critics of globalization, as well as some of those who think it's a highly beneficial and desirable process, you see a picture of a world in which multinationals are homeless, they have no national roots, they move anywhere at any time, paying almost no attention to culture, and then states are stripped of nearly all of their powers, they're powerless. Now, I think that picture, which is welcomed by business utopians such as Kenichi Omai in Japan, and which is criticized sharply by Greens, socialists, and others, I think it's far removed from the reality. It's true, of course, that sovereign states, nation states, have lost some of the control they possessed over economic life in earlier times, particularly in the post-war period. That's perfectly true. And it's also true, and I think this is worth worth stressing, that in many parts of the world, modern states barely exist. It's worth saying that one of the less thought about phenomena of our time, although it is thought about in some contexts, such as defense contexts, one of the less investigated and dwelt upon phenomena of our time is the phenomenon of state collapse and state enfeeblement. That is to say, in many parts of the world, there are practically no states left. The writ of the local governments runs on a few issues, perhaps throughout the country on many issues, only to the suburbs of the capital. States such as Afghanistan, Pakistan, Albania, Georgia, Colombia, large parts of Africa are parts of the world in which the state is one of the least important political or social actors. It has shrunken or collapsed or turned out to be, practically speaking, impotent. And here I'll just draw your attention to a further aspect of this shrinkage in the power and importance of states, but not the disappearance or the impotence of sovereign states, which is that to a considerable extent, states no longer control even the institution of war. If you look back over the modern period, one of the defining features, at least in standard conventional accounts of the modern state, is that states acquired a sort of monopoly of force, a monopoly of the control of violence in the 17th century or thereabouts, since the Treaty of Westphalia, and they became the principal actors in war. Now, of course, in some contexts, they still are the principal actors in war, where wars involve a tremendous amount of hardware, when they can be afforded only by a few or one or two very prosperous or affluent countries, or where they involve very long distance projection of power. Two obvious cases are the Gulf War or the Falklands War. Then states are probably the only entities that can fight those wars. But on the whole, in the last 10 or 20 or 30 years, what's been significant is the way in which the institution of war or the practice of war has slipped the noose of state control. For the most part, wars aren't controlled in the way that they once were by states. The old-fashioned classical or Clausewitzian model of war as an institution of organized violence in which the protagonists are the agents of states fits a diminishing number of wars. And I mention that only and draw attention to that to point to the ways in which it is true that states have lost leverage, have lost power. I also mentioned, by the way, that the decline in the state's control over war, the decline in Clausewitzian war, might not be altogether a benign thing, because insofar as states can no longer control the activity of war in the way that they did in recent centuries, it's also true that they can no longer enforce peace. So paradoxically, one might say that a revival of Clausewitzian war was a precondition of secure peace, but that sounds like a paradox. I think it's not a paradox. It's perhaps just a banal truth. But although all of this is true, nation states nonetheless remain important sites of power. How do we know this? Well, we know it, I think, partly from the fact that multinationals compete for their favors. Multinationals don't ignore states. They don't carry on their policies as if states didn't exist or had no significance for them. They compete to influence the decisions of states. And increasingly, states compete to acquire investment by multinationals. But this is a two-way process. It's bilateral. It's not one in which multinationals become more and more powerful and states become less and less powerful. It's a bilateral exchange. So the very fact that multinational companies treat states as sites or institutions which they should colonize, exert influence over, suggests to me and many others that states do have quite a bit of leeway left to them. Although some of the policies they pursued in the past have become harder to pursue nowadays. If it's true, for example, that global markets, bond markets, for example, have a kind of allergy to Keynesian deficit financing, if that's true, as some people think it is, reading the history of the Mitterrand experiment in the early 80s, or even accounts of Bill Clinton's first months and years in the White House, if it's true that policies were abandoned or not even considered because it was believed they would be rapidly destabilized by bond markets, if it's true that one of the factors leading to the implosion of Swedish social democracy was the fact that it was believed, or it was actually true, that global bond markets wouldn't tolerate the degree of fiscal laxity they perceived in social democratic Sweden, then, if those things are true, certain classically social democratic policies cease to be as available as they were before. They might even cease to be practicable. But that doesn't mean that nation states have no leverage at all. Finally, globalization isn't, and this is perhaps one of the most important things I want to argue, the universal reach of a single type of capitalism. Globalization isn't a return to the Anglo-Saxon free market. On the contrary, one of globalization's most notable effects has been to spawn new types of capitalism, e.g. Russian capitalism. So I think one of the central ideas, which is that as globalization advances, the practices and norms and values, the types of institutions that are characteristic or distinctive of the highly individualist capitalisms of English-speaking countries, such as Britain and the United States, that these will become universal or more general. There are some contexts of regulation. There are some contexts of financial institutions in which that seems to be happening. But it's by no means general, still less universal. And to think that way really leads us to pass over one of the more interesting and, for the future important features of globalization, which is its tendency to transform even existing types of capitalism. If one thinks of globalization only as spanning the last decade, I think it's certainly arguable that neither German capitalism, nor Japanese capitalism, nor Anglo-American capitalism are now in centrally important respects what they were 10 years ago. There has been fundamental change. One can even argue, I think, that each of these so-called models, each of these so-called varieties or cultures of capitalism, is in a process of unpredictable mutation, whose outcome we don't know. But that's a very different picture from the one you get in standard business, journalistic, and even some academic writings, in which what's happening is essentially and primarily that other types of capitalism are being marginalized and the juggernaut of the Anglo-Saxon model is advancing. That treats, as it were, globalization now as a process of competition in which the Anglo-Saxon model has won by default. I think that neglects the way in which Anglo-Saxon capitalism has itself been transforming itself. The most fundamental implication of intensified global competition now is not to produce homogeneity in types of capitalism. It's to spawn new types and transform old types. It's to throw all the different cultures of capitalism into a flux, and I think this is a decisive point. So to conclude this part of what I want to say briefly, we've got to distinguish sharply and clearly between globalization as an inexorable but nonetheless open-ended historical process and globalization as a neoliberal political project. That project aims to replicate the free markets of Anglo-Saxon capitalism throughout the world as a single universal free market. But nothing in globalization guarantees that outcome or even makes it particularly likely. On the contrary, there are some good reasons for thinking that neoliberal project is utopian, that it is in fact incompatible with the world that globalization is creating. Why have I argued in my book and elsewhere that a global free market is a utopia? Why have I argued that something which many people take to be not only a reality, but something which is going to be with us forever? By the way, I think many people are utopians about the present. That's to say, they don't see its costs or risks, and they also think it's eternal. I don't see why one should take that view. I think, in fact, there are four identifiable reasons why a global free market is likely to prove pretty short-lived and why it can't be fully achieved at all. The first is that its exemplar, its mid-Victorian exemplar, was itself an historical singularity. 19th century laissez-faire occurred in a specific historical context in which there had been a long period of agrarian capitalism in England. But it was nevertheless an artifact of state power. It's important to realize that the free market in England did not emerge from a long, slow series of changes. It was not the result of an unplanned historical evolution. Karl Polanyi, in his, as yet, I think, insufficiently studied, even now, book, The Great Transformation, I don't agree with every aspect of it, but I think it's still a very important book, wrote, the road to the free market was opened and kept open by a continuous, by an enormous increase in continuous, centrally organized and controlled interventionism. So the free market is not something that comes about when state power retreats. The free market is an artifact of state power, and this can be shown in contexts in which the free market has been engineered in existence. The paradox is, and Polanyi's book, I think, is a very useful exposition of this paradox, is that mid-19th century laissez-faire required the extensive and deliberate use of state power, whereas it disappeared as a result of spontaneous, unplanned evolution. The mid-19th century free market never existed completely, but it existed to some extent, was gradually reformed out of existence, gradually withered away, if you like, as a result of hundreds or thousands of pieces of separate legislation which were responses to particular problems, problems of industrial safety, problems of public health, problems of efficiency. It gradually disappeared, not as a result of any grand plan, but because its actual working came up against strong human interests and needs, in particular, needs for economic security, and in particular, needs for ongoing social cohesion. And the way in which it was legislated out of existence is instructive in that as democracy advanced, in other words, as these human needs found opportunities, gained opportunities for political expression, the rigors of the purer forms of the free market in Britain were softened or diminished. And in fact, I think far from what American neoconservatives and Francis Fukuyama and others have called democratic capitalism, far from it being the case that democracy and free markets are natural allies, I think democracy and unrestricted free markets are actually, in the long run, in an inherently unstable partnership. Wherever there has been fairly extensive democratic government, you find that, not that there are no market economies, there are, not that you necessarily find anything resembling socialism, you don't, typically. What you find instead is, I think, regulated markets, markets which are constrained with a view to protecting important individual and social interests. So the combination in the late modern world of democratic government and free markets is, I think, unstable. But the free market is unstable for another reason. And in the time left to me, I can only mention it, not justify it or defend it. Like unmanaged free markets in the past, it's liable to discoordination and to cycles of boom and bust. Yet, except in periods of crisis, the global economy doesn't really have global governance. Except as a crisis avoiding measure, a catastrophe avoiding measure, it doesn't. And I think that's an important point to bear in mind. There's nothing like global macroeconomic management. The final respect in which I think a global free market is likely to prove short-lived is that the mechanisms it contains for conserving scarce natural resources are inadequate. I mean, basically, the only really functioning mechanism that it contains is the price mechanism itself. As I say, those who think that a global free market is compatible with environmental or ecological stability say, well, as resources dry up or get more expensive, new ones will be discovered, invention and discovery will have increased incentives, and so this benign process will go on. We'll never really face problems of severe resource shortage. Well, I think that is a utopia for a pretty simple reason, which is that price mechanisms don't operate in a political or a military vacuum. To argue like this presupposes that property rights, political institutions, rule of law remain stable throughout the world in such a way that the price, I don't think it would necessarily work. But market pricing of scarce natural resources, on the contrary, is highly malleable to political and military intervention. And I think some of the arms build-ups in part of the world, particularly in East Asia, are not unconnected with national rivalries for natural resources. And so one of the fears that I have for the future is that wars may well be fueled by resource competition, by rivalry for dwindling natural resources. What are the alternatives then? Well, let me just briefly mention some alternatives which I take to be false or illusory or mistaken or perverse alternatives to a global free market. I mention them only briefly in order to reject them. Protectionism, fundamentalism, and Luddism. Let's take the last first. Luddism meaning hostility to new technology, or at any rate the view that new technologies can or should be renounced. Why do I say that's a false alternative? Well, the power of new technology seems to me, in the first place, to be nearly irresistible. Controlling and having a balanced relationship with new technologies is one of our most intractable problems. It's likely to prove pretty difficult and pretty intractable, whatever we do. And the notion that we can or ought to renounce it seems to me to be fly in the face of human needs and really to be dealing in a realm of a fantasy. Why do I think like this? Well, for a number of reasons. First of all, at present we live in a regime not of global governance, but of international quasi-anarchy. By that I mean that even if restraints on new technologies are introduced in some and implemented and enforced in some jurisdiction in the world, they will be circumvented and ignored or violated in other parts of the world where that jurisdiction does not apply. Take an example. The European Parliament has discussed, and actually I think even voted on, proposals for the control of new types of genetic engineering technologies. It's voted in favor of restricting or limiting their application, something that many, including I myself, would think is desirable. But even if that became law throughout the European Union countries, it wouldn't stop those types of experimentation and technological development being pushed ahead in other parts of the world. Indeed, it would create an incentive for the firms which wish to pursue them to move and elude the jurisdiction. So one of the really intractable problems of constraining or controlling new technologies comes from the fact that there are many different jurisdictions in the world. There are parts of the world, as I've already said, where there is no functioning state and therefore no functioning law, which are therefore beyond the writ, really, of these any jurisdiction, in which new technologies can be applied, developed, even if they're very dangerous or very harmful. If you think that that's too blanket a statement, let me give you an example which I would invoke to support it. Consider nuclear proliferation. If you wanted to think of a technology which the most powerful agents in the world have had reasons, I don't say there were always good reasons, there are arguments the other way, but they've had very powerful reasons for wanting to limit, to control, to restrain, or even to reduce the proliferation of nuclear weapons technologies would be an example. But we know that attempts to prevent the proliferation of nuclear weapons have failed. So given that that is the case in that instance, where there has been a consensus, right or wrong, among the great powers, where considerable efforts have been devoted to implementing it and making sure it's effective, I think we're entitled to be reasonably cautious about the prospects of limiting even damaging and dangerous new technologies in the future. Furthermore, any people which attempted to renounce technology would find itself, as perhaps the Tibetans did in the 50s, open to destruction by a more powerful neighbor. But also I think this represents both an underestimate of the difficulties of controlling technologies, but also an essentially perverse underestimate of the possibilities that at least potentially in some regime of global governance would be open for using new technologies to human benefit. There's nothing inherently destructive about new technologies. Even as things are, they're sometimes highly emancipating. It's a mistake to think of an alternative to globalization in terms of halting it, which is what Luddites want to do. It's almost as if I even heard one say, we must ban globalization, which to me is like saying we must ban gravity or we must ban the weather because it's sometimes harmful or inconvenient. It can't be done. What about fundamentalism, which is a type, I suppose, of cultural Luddism? Well, if one asks what fundamentalism was, I suppose one could say it was an attempt to roll back the diversity, the cultural diversity of late modern societies. It too, I take it, is bound to fail. Traditional social orders are nowhere viable in an age of continuous technological revolution. The bottom line in late modern societies is that a return to traditional values or traditional institutions is an impossibility everywhere in the world. That's the bottom line. Now, in this respect, I think neoliberalism was a fundamentalist project, because what neoliberalism wanted to achieve was a combination of deregulated markets and new technologies with Victorian values, whatever they were. And the failure of that project in Britain and elsewhere, although it was attended by many contingent historical causes and accidents, wasn't itself an historical accident. It came about because the attempt to combine unrestricted, deregulated freedom of markets and an uncritical and radical embrace of new technologies with the values of already vanished or disintegrating traditions is an attempt to achieve the impossible. It failed, in other words, not because of errors, betrayals, mistakes, defections, or whatever. It failed because it was incompatible, neoliberalism, with some of the most fundamental processes going on in late modern societies. It was incompatible with their tendency to constant self-transformation through the dissemination of new technologies and the reality that all late modern societies are in continuous interactions with each other. Other fundamentalist projects, whether or not they're religious, will fail, I think, for the same reason. Fundamentalism isn't really, and I'm not thinking only of religious fundamentalism, neoliberalism wasn't in that sense religious. Fundamentalism isn't really an alternative to modernity. It's an exacerbation of modernity. It arises only in societies in which tradition has already collapsed. You might even say fundamentalism is a pathology of post-traditional societies. Or as the Viennese wit Karl Kraus is supposed to have said of psychoanalysis, fundamentalism is a symptom of the disease of which it pretends to be the cure. What of protectionism? Just briefly. Well, think of that of Pat Buchanan. I take that kind of protectionism to be a type of economic nationalism. It's an attempted revival of some aspects of the early modern state in a context of late modernity. But I think in our context, that's anachronistic and somewhat perverse. The most serious environmental problems we face know nothing of the Treaty of Westphalia that originated the modern state. They're indifferent to borders and blind to sovereignty. Attempting to revive the early modern state by demanding that nation states recontrol trade wouldn't do anything to resolve or mitigate environmental problems in our time. Indeed, it could work to aggravate them. Economic nationalism of that kind seems to me to be just a dead end. It has familiar problems, so familiar. I'll just list them, not talk about them. Since it's unilateral, it provokes tit-for-tat responses from others. It confers undeserved and inefficient super profits on the industries lucky enough to be protected. And it triggers a political struggle for protection in which government ends up a distributor of privileges. All of that is so familiar, I won't repeat it again. But actually, those reasons are not the deep reasons why protectionism is a dead end. The deep reason is that the dislocations of employment which have occurred in late modern societies have very little to do with trade and almost everything to do with the new technologies that are revolutionizing the social division of labor. These things can be to some inexact degree measured, and the contribution of trade, except in a few low-skilled manufacturing jobs, is slight. The real change is vis-a-vis new technologies. As I said at the start, protectionism wouldn't treat those deep problems. It would create a situation in which these same processes go on behind tariff walls. Finally, is there an alternative to this? I hope I've not done what a legendary Polish syndicalist is supposed to have done in the late 19th century, given an enormously long lecture in which he proved that certain problems that his audience thought were difficult were in fact completely insoluble. I hope that's not the result of my reflections. Is there then an alternative, a real alternative? But what would the alternative look like in the first place to the global free market? There's no alternative to globalization, nor should there be. As I pointed out, that's inexorable. But what would an alternative to a global free market look like? Well, the first point I think that needs to be accepted is that ideas of world governance which involve the universal imposition of a single type of economy, a single form of market institutions, a single type of capitalism, should be abandoned. Instead, we should treat differences between different types of market economy, differences between economic systems, as potentially and actually productive and helpful. What we should be thinking in terms of is not any universal economic system, but modus vivendi between types of economic systems that will always remain importantly different. So the framework which we need to be thinking of, and it needs to be necessarily global, I think, in an age of globalization, is one which is hospitable to, which shelters, which is respectful of the different types of capitalism, the different types of market economy that exist and will come to exist in the world because of differences, not only in traditions and histories, but also in present circumstances and needs, and even differences of geography and access to natural resources. So there needs to be, it seems to me, a basic shift in economic philosophy away from the idea that there is a single type of economic system which is suitable and beneficial everywhere, to, this seems to be the more commonsensical idea, that different types of economic culture, of institutions and practices will be beneficial in different contexts because they'll serve different people with different needs, different histories, and different present aspirations and ambitions. How would this work out in practice? Well, I say in my book, and I still say this, that it's less important to try and specify in advance, which I think is a pretty hopeless project, what these changes are, than to see that such changes are necessary. But since I wrote the book, and even since I published the book, since the Asian dislocations, there have been proposals, even from within the World Bank and elsewhere, for some reforms of the present regime of wholly unrestricted freedom of capital movements. It's been suggested by some that the kind of constraints or limits on quicksilver capital that Chile and some other countries have could be usefully adopted by other countries. And that small suggestion, still extremely heterodox and flying in the face of a powerful conventional wisdom, is around in the world. That kind of talk about reform is not restricted to contrarian critics of, like myself. It's actually found in the transnational organizations themselves to some extent. There's been talk of reestablishment or establishment of new fixed exchange or semi-fixed exchange currency regimes. There's been talk of a variety of changes which reassert not the old controls, because they might not work, but new types of regulation and control of the mobility of at least some kinds of capital and even some kind of limitation in some contexts of trade. So it's no longer the case, I think, that this is a completely wild utopian notion. But I'll conclude by posing a few difficulties for it. I hope not in the spirit of my 19th century Polish syndicalist, charming as he sounds to have been. Why might it be difficult to get a shift? Well, first of all, there isn't sufficient consensus on the objectives. There's certainly no consensus on the need for planning of natural resource consumption, or at least of management of it, above and beyond the use of the price mechanism. There's no consensus on population policy, though most of the countries that practice it are not Western countries, but actually countries like India, China, Iran, and Egypt. There's no consensus whatever on the necessity on that, and it doesn't look likely as if there will be one. There's not even a consensus on the reality of global warming. There's not even a sufficient consensus to say that that is a reality, or even if it isn't a reality, it's a sufficiently catastrophic risk that we should guard against it in case it proves to be a reality. Instead, I recently saw a report of a Panglossian account in which it said that, well, it probably isn't a reality, but if it is a reality, it's almost certain that it'll be wholly beneficial. For some reason, I'm not wholly persuaded. Perhaps it's misanthropy. So I think in those kind of contexts, there's not enough consensus. Or to put it in a different way, in order to have a shift from our present anomalous combination of a half-constructed and, in my view, incompletable global free market with large areas of anarchy or quasi-anarchy, in order to have some move from there, we would need unprecedentedly high levels of international cooperation. We'd need levels of international cooperation adopted not just in response to emergencies or not just for empty symmetry with its endless production of Panglossian, invariably cheerful, however tragic and difficult the reality, verbiage. We'd need actual ongoing international cooperation. Is this utopian? I'll leave that to you to decide.
Well, thanks very much. We've got certain time for questions. John said he was going to tell the only known joke about globalization, but there seemed to be several, so I couldn't quite figure out which one it was. Anyway, we do have time for questions if anyone would like to ask any.
Yes, please go ahead.
I have a question about There is a mic somewhere.
There's supposed to be a roving mic, but I don't know where it is. No, there it is.
Roving back again.
Thanks. I've got a question about cultural protectionism as opposed to economic protectionism, because I think you're a bit sanguine about the arrival of the same Hollywood images over large parts of the world, and there are ways in which that feeds back into the economics of cultural production in countries. I'm thinking of, for example, Eastern Europe, mm-hmm. where the establishment of indigenous cultural production is very difficult. And mm-hmm. I'm even thinking of things like the growth of English as a global mm-hmm. language, mm-hmm. carrying its own sets of meanings at the expense mm-hmm. of other possible mm-hmm. global languages. And I wondered if you felt that there was something different about cultural protectionism than economic protectionism.
Well, I think it's sometimes necessary and sometimes can work. I mean, if one thinks of the... it's sometimes desirable and sometimes feasible. I mean, if one thinks of the negotiations that went up to the GATT agreement a few years ago, the French, not the British, unfortunately, but the French fought a... heroically bloody-minded, in my view, defense of cultural protectionism, and they prevailed to some limited extent. And I think that's beneficent. So I don't oppose, on the contrary, I support those types of measure. And I also think it's true, you mentioned Eastern Europe, I think one of the least studied features of post-communist countries is the way in which one of its inheritances from the past and one of the inheritances which it actually carried on to some limited extent, namely a superior system of education, has been compromised in nearly all post-communist countries, partly by the impoverishment of teachers. I mean, if a teacher earns a 20th of what he or she can earn by going to commerce, then that profession is rapidly demoralized. So. It never occurred to me that I would find myself in a position of seeing post-communism as a situation in which civilized institutions get wrecked. But that has happened to some extent. It is happening. So you're right to focus on that. And that there is a though I would say that's not a question of cultural protectionism. That's a question of the distribution of resources in the society and the neglect of public services and sectors. That's a more, if you like, a kind of more brute aspect of the operation of economies now. It's less subtle than the cultural phenomena. I favour it. I would favour it on a European level. I don't think it would solve everything. I don't think it would. I don't think it would necessarily keep all the traditions alive. But at any rate, it would resist those aspects of globalization, which is, we have a truly imperialist aspect to dimension to them.
I wondered if you had any thought. Can you hear me?
Only just. I don't think it's on. I don't think it's on. Globalization, you see. New technologies.
I wondered if you had any thoughts about intellectual property and would the breakdown of control of intellectual property be a sort of sea change in to avoid the worst excesses of neoliberalism?
Well, that would be a sort of cheerful interpretation of what is in fact happening. I'm told by people in business, particularly large firms, that as an actual reality, there isn't in many contexts nowadays, there isn't really intellectual property, that it's often not worth attempting to enforce it. And that, as I said earlier, in some, either because there are sovereign states that don't recognize it or because there are parts of the world in which there aren't really sovereign states anymore, intellectual property rights just don't exist anymore. That's to say, it's taken for granted that certain types of ideas or inventions just will be copied or will appear somewhere within almost months, or at least a couple of years. So actually, in the world as it is now, there isn't a fully functioning, by any means, set of rights of intellectual property. And that actually may be, as you're suggesting, it's an interesting idea. It's kind of one respect in which one can be comparatively cheerful about the present realities, in which it's not as bad as it could be. Now, if, however, we get to the situation which is actively being proposed in discussions around the MAI and others, in which
Even naturally occurring substances can be patented. Even parts of the human body can be patented. Traditional herbal medicines can be patented. So they can only be, if they became patentable, and if the patent, if we moved, as it were, from an extraordinarily messy anarchy to a situation of a genuinely functioning global free market, which I don't think we will, that would be a great worsening of our present circumstance, it seems to me. And so I take the spirit of your question. Yes, please, there's a mic.
I was very interested in your assertion earlier on that globalization doesn't necessarily involve homogenization. But I was wondering, you know, whether we consider the economic aspects or the cultural aspect, there does seem to be a large slice of westernization in globalization, and surely that has homogenizing effects.
Well, that's certainly true to a considerable extent, but it's interesting though how it's true. I think to the extent that globalization has incurred rapid westernization, it's also produced powerful backlashes. And among the backlashes, among our fundamentalist movements, it's rarely noted by in the press, certainly, that fundamentalism is alluded to as if it were some extraordinary mass hysteria that comes from nowhere, rather than characteristically occurring in circumstances of very profound, rapid modernization and change. So, although I think it's true that globalization does involve westernization, or has done so, it also produces backlashes. But there's a deeper point I'd like to make. If one looks over the last 100 years or so, the spread of new technologies to other cultures has not always involved unequivocal or complete westernization by any means. After all, it's arguable that the second industrialized country in the world was Japan. It was certainly very early, began to do so in the seventh decade of the 19th century, and by the turn of the century had constructed a modern navy, for example. That was very early. And that was against the background of which some Western ideas and practices were imported. For example, types of commercial law, the organization of the navy itself, and some others, but far from wholesale. So the idea that this spread of new technologies in and of itself, which is the essence of, or the motor of globalization, that itself promotes westernization seems to me to be doubtful. And also, I would even say something else, it seems to me that even the very idea of westernization is becoming slightly anachronistic. I mean, what is the West now? I mean, I wonder if 20 years from now, when one listens to the news, one hears this, to me, already slightly anomalous discourse of the West took the view that, well, what does that mean nowadays? It seems to be almost a harking back to the strategic alliances of the Cold War. It doesn't seem to have all that much else in common. If one reads Samuel Huntington's book on the clash of civilizations, as I did 3 times in order to discover how many civilizations were clashing, I tried hard to come up with his account of what a civilization was, and whether or not it belonged to the West or not. And what I finally concluded that a civilization was actually a politically well-organized American minority. In other words, a civilization was an American lobby. And the reason for that is all the ones he mentions fit that category. He's doubtful, for example, I found this quite puzzling, Greece, which clearly in some sense has been and is a civilization, he says doesn't belong to the West, and he's dubious about Israel. I don't think that this discourse makes all that much sense in an age of irreversible cultural interpenetration and nearly universal multiculturalism. I think it would be better if we dropped it altogether.
My name's Alison Harvey. I'd like to take up the last point. I think the UN Social Development Forum in Copenhagen in 1995, which looked very much at globalization, came out very much with the fact that now we have polarization within countries rather than between countries, and diversity within countries rather than between countries, and that therefore what were the models that we had to use to deal with that. Certainly in terms of globalization, where I live in Ealing in West London, we're a very, I think, non-racial, but I prefer that to multicultural, because I think multicultural puts people in boxes. a very non-racial society, in which the ideas of health from the West, from the East, are just as strong as Western medicine, and we've got a better incorporation. My experience has been with South Africa, and I believe that South Africa and Africa will in fact be producing models of democracy and people-centered development, participatory democracy, and especially consensus building and conflict resolution, all of which are models which we are going to need in our increasingly polarized society. And that really, unless we get passionate about the marginalization of people and the fact that you know, so many people in Britain, as well as everybody else living in the so-called third world, none of this sort of academic stuff is going to work.
Well, I mean, I'll just endorse that. I mean, even at the level of economic transfers, it's by no means always the case now that multinationals move south in order to find cheaper labour. They often move north to find cheaper labour nowadays. For example, I think it's true that in comparable economic activities, wages are higher in Taiwan and South Korea, at least they were before the recent crisis, than they are in Wales and large parts of Britain. So that actually some of the moves are south-north. So it's by no means the case any longer, even at the crass level, at the sort of gross level of movement of production of that kind, that there are the old distinctions we used to take for granted. I think globalization, as it goes on, really erodes all those and makes them almost meaningless. And it does, to some extent, create the diversities and marginalizations within societies that you're speaking of.
I was interested in your descriptions as to what drives globalization, and you seem to reduce the causes of it to just one factor, the inexorable application of the new technologies, and not market deregulation and so on. Well, isn't this just a technological determinism, and as such, does it not miss an awful lot of factors? For instance, aren't some of the factors driving globalization the imperatives of capital, i.e. search for new markets, product innovation, all of those things, underlying those things being the inexorable need of capital to generate surplus value?
Well, yes, there's something in that. I mean, it would be wrong for me to deny that that is part of the process. But certainly, I mean, I hope not to have suggested a kind of technological fatalism, but it is true that the primary motor of it, as I see it, is the growth of technology. But that is a pretty powerful motor, and it covers an awful lot of things. If you say, well, it's also capitalism, I'd also agree. But after all, earlier in this century, industrialization, which is an aspect of this diffusion of new technologies in the world, was very rapidly, very relentlessly, and in some respects, perhaps mistakenly, advanced by non-capitalist regimes, for example, in the Soviet Union. So I don't think it can be true in general that, perhaps you don't think this, but I don't think it can be true in general that the spread of new technologies is a kind of what philosophers used to call it, an epiphenomenon. That's to say, it's that the spread of new technologies is just caused by capitalism, just caused by the relentless search for profit. It seems to me, as it were, that these technologies have almost I don't say they're not being exploited for profit, they obviously are, but they have almost a kind of momentum of their own. They have a kind of appeal and a capacity to replicate, which I think is enormously powerful. But of course, in saying, as I did, that there is now only one economic system in the world, although it has a number of varieties, I was, in a sense, conceding part of your point. There is now only capitalism in the world. The question is whether, I suppose, the interesting question of theory is this: are people who are still attached to some aspect of classical Marxism right when they say that out of all these culturally different capitalisms of which I speak, will emerge, or already exists, a sort of generic capitalism which transcends all cultures and uses all cultures as just disposable instruments of its purposes? That's one darkly economically deterministic view. Or is the view that I take myself, that capitalisms are and will remain
deeply culturally embedded, that the attempt to disembed them never works, that it produces great social costs and leads to backlashes, so that there will in fact always be, even if there are only capitalism in the world, there will always be different types of capitalism, even radically different types of capitalism. Which of those two views is true? I think that is one of the most interesting questions of social theory at the moment.
Because of the mess up about starting time, I'm afraid there's only time for one more question, so I'll let John pick from the variety of hands on display.
I don't know if there's a...
Could have used the mic so people upstairs could also hear.
My question is about the different forms of capitalism we were talking about. After the Asian crisis, when the IMF was suggesting solutions to, say, South Korea, most of the solutions were not which would automatically emerge from the kind of situation South Korea was in, but more of a Western model of solutions. So don't you think that finally it'll all move towards the American, English, Anglo-Saxon model of capitalism?
Let me try and answer that. It's a very interesting question. The IMF solutions, interesting feature about IMF solutions is they seem to be indifferent to the problem. They're absolutely universal. Someone gets off a plane in Bucharest, hands over the... and that maybe same person gets off the plane in Jakarta, perhaps just hands over a photocopy. I don't think I'm actually caricaturing it too savagely. And so I think it's certainly true that the idea that economic rationality and economic wisdom lie in this universal set of westernized institutions is very strong in these transnational organizations. But look at what it's doing in practice. You see, the good side about not being a utopian is you never expect utopias to come about. And this kind of dystopian notion of projecting to the last corner of the earth the particular practices of Anglo-Saxon capitalism is not going to happen. In the Indonesian case, it seems to have had some role in triggering a large-scale political collapse, perhaps of a regime that deserved to collapse, but also ruining the country economically in the process. It's a fairly large price to pay for a change of government. In the Korean case, I know little about, but it seems to me unlikely that an economic model based upon severely reducing trade union power in one of the few countries in the world in which there are still powerful trade unions, hacking away at the corporate welfare state in a country in which nearly all the welfare state is corporate. That's to say that your education, your health care, your children's education and health care, your spouses, all depend on your corporate relationship, your relationship with your firm. A situation in which long-term unemployment has been rare. It seems to be unlikely that a set of prescriptions, which for the medium term of 5, 10 or 15 years, might produce great losses in all of these areas, is going to be politically acceptable. I don't know whether it will be or not. I just have doubts. Based, if you like, upon the notion that Koreans are not too different from I myself. That's to say that I would dislike the imposition of that degree of loss and risk for so long, with so speculative an outcome, when the outcome at the end of it is that I become something different from what I am now. It seems to me that that's not a self-evidently compelling bargain, particularly in a democracy, which South Korea now is. So I would perhaps conclude by saying that that leads me to reaffirm my central idea, and I think it's the central notion that's important, not the details, because the details will depend upon the circumstances in which reform is introduced. Will reform be introduced in a situation of some difficulty, but less than major dislocation? Or will it have to wait, as I myself think is likely, for much larger levels of dislocation? What then needs to be done, if anything can be done, will very much depend upon those circumstances. But the basic idea of reform seems to me that it should be that of not arriving with the same set of solutions to immensely and irreducibly diverse problems and difficulties, but instead of looking at how different peoples, different cultures, with historically different types of market economy can improve them to meet their vital needs. That idea of a global economic framework harboring a number of types of economy which will always remain permanently remain different. In other words, the differences that they exhibit are not, as it were, stages on the way to some universal single type of economy, but they're permanent and legitimate and actually add value to the world rather than being merely transitionally useful. That idea of modus vivendi between different economic systems seems to me to be the idea that should guide reform.
Thank you.
Just before we close, can I just say one or two things? There is a reception now to which anyone here is invited. This also seems to have changed because apparently it was supposed to be in the senior common room, but it's now in the Shaw Library, which is on the sixth floor of the old building. For anyone who's surreptitiously clutching a copy of False Dawn, John is available to sign your copy, should you so wish, either here or outside, to be determined. For those who think John is too gloomy, can I remind you that I believe it's the case, False Dawn is always followed by True Dawn. And I'd like to thank him very, very much for his lecture tonight and welcome everyone to reception after this. Thanks very much.